afternoon by telling you a story. It's a Sufi story. I hope I can remember it well. And it's a story about a spiritual seeker, a man who spends years of his life searching and seeking. And you know, he reads many books, he visits many teachers, and there are times when he has reads these books or meets with these teachers that he has really wonderful experiences, really inspired, and it's really, everything seems right and he's on the right good path and just elated, it feels really great. And other times when he's confused and doesn't know what's up and what's down. Other times where he gets kind of betrayed or feels disappointed, feels like he's gone down a dead end sometimes. But it all changes and he's never quite sure. He never feels like he reaches the goal of what he's been seeking. And he's somewhat discouraged, but he's still seeking. And then one day he comes across this this sage of great repute, great sage. And his name is Kadir. And he, you know, he explains the situation to Kadir, and Kadir says, "Oh, come with me." So it seems promising. This great sage is going to show him something that, after listening to his story and his despair. And so he takes him and he brings him to a place where all the people in this place are in great distress and misery. And it's kind of a gray place, and all the trees have withered and plants have died, and just like kind of, you know, miserable place. And so the seeker asks Kadir, you know, what's with these people? And Kadir says, "Oh, these are the people who were always running away from life, who had aversion. Had aversion to what life was like, aversion to themselves, and were always striking at life, pushing it away or going away from it." Okay, so then Kadir says, "Come with me." And so they go someplace else, and they come to this other place. And here's a place where everybody's looks very attractive, and it's like a garden party, and everybody's very happy, and you know, it's kind of like, you know, like an English garden, and all the plants are well tended and growing beautifully, and it's very nice. And so the seeker asks, "Well, what's with these people?" And Kadir said, "Well, these are the people who didn't find the truth." And he says, "What? But these are the people who are so happy." And Kadir says, "Yes, they're happy because they pursued happiness, but they confused happiness with truth. And so this is what they got. They got to be happy." So you probably wonder, "Well, that's pretty good. I'll take that." But and then Kadir goes on to explain that people often confuse happiness with truth and joy for truth, but that the truth has no particular state that is the state of truth, that you can find truth in the midst of compassion, in the midst of sadness, in the midst of fear, in the midst of whatever's going on. You don't have to find truth only in a state of happiness or joy. And that if many people, in confusing happiness for truth, will miss truth, and sometimes, occasionally, you know, if they're pursuing happiness, sometimes attain happiness. And there's many people in the world who pursue certain things, maybe not many, but certain number of people who pursue certain ideals, certain things that they want, and are successful at it, and therefore have a certain happiness, certain contentment perhaps, and then they go along that way and they retire and they die. One of my things that I feel blessed by, things I feel kind of fortunate to being, is that I was never super smart. I was, you know, kind of, I could get along quite well in school and all that, but I was never a super smart student. So some of the things that I wanted to do, that I wasn't good enough to succeed at some of them. And I look back at my life now at some of the strange ideas that I wanted to pursue, that I probably would have, if I'd been really good at it, I probably would have pursued this, and I would have gotten some satisfaction in doing it well, but that I would have continued to live my life in a kind of half-awake kind of mode. I would have kind of pursued certain ideals or purposes, or I would have stayed in the values that I'd inherited, that I grew up with, without really questioning them, going beyond them. And because I wasn't particularly successful at the particular kind of pursuits I had when I was a young man, I didn't get stuck in certain kind of identities of who I felt like I had to be. And so it actually kept me kind of fluid and loose to keep looking further for the truth, to find something deeper that was true about life. And I've known people who've, you know, been successful in life, and they've gotten a certain level of wealth, certain level of success in their jobs or whatever, and then they can rest on that contently, and a certain level of security, and then they come and they retire. And some people, when they retire, kind of they wake up and say, "What was that about?" And some people who retire, you know, don't wake up. They kind of say, "Oh, well, now I have all this money. I think I'll go on cruises, and I think I'll do all these wonderful things." And it's wonderful and a lot of joy, but it's not the same thing as truth. It's not the same thing as seeing deeply what is true about themselves, what's true about life, looking at life underneath the currents of success. And then there's a lot of people who are not successful, who don't have a successful career, don't make a lot of money or whatever, and measure any kind of thing that brings kind of worldly happiness. And one result of that can be disappointment, a lot of misery, and there can also be born a lot of aversion and a lot of hate from not having enough success, to be being frustrated in our attempts to get things. But the pursuit of truth is different than the pursuit of happiness. So then the seeker asks Khidir, you know, thanked him for this lesson he got, and says, "Well, can I ask you one thing? Advice for one thing?" And Khidir said, "Yes." And the seeker asked, "Where have I gone wrong? You know, I spent years and years searching. Where is it that I've gone wrong, since I haven't found what I was searching for?" And Khidir was actually quite pointed to him, and quite kind of strongly said, "It's because you lived a life, your life has been a lie. Rather than pursuing the truth, you've lived a life of a lie. And the way you lived the life of a lie is you've actually, rather than pursuing the truth, you've pursued self-gratification." And I think many of us, an example I gave before of pursuing success at work or success in, you know, money and all these kinds of things, many people can realize, well, that's, you know, it's nice to have, but, you know, they're not ultimate, and they're not the ultimate source of happiness. But self-gratification, that's the kind of the great word, Californian word of the 80s and 90s, right? We all deserve self-gratification. But Khidir actually says even pursuing self-gratification is not the same thing as truth. What is truth? And is it interesting to pursue the truth? Is it interesting to have that to be the goal of a life, or goal of one's spiritual life? One of the interesting confusions, perhaps, that people have in their encounter with Buddhism is the confusion between the word desire, because on one hand it seems like the Buddhists are consider desire to be the source of suffering, but then it seems to be many desires which seem a necessary part of our lives, and maybe even a nice part of our lives. And are we supposed to give up all our desires? Is that what Buddhism is saying? And it's not what Buddhism is saying. It's kind of a misunderstanding, but it's an easy one to get to the way we talk. It's a particular kind of desires. It's desires that are compulsive, or desires which have a spin of greed or of hate or of aversion or resistance as part of them. The spin of desire of clinging or of aversion or resistance or fear or compulsion, those spins contain within them all kinds of suffering. They're suffering in and of themselves. And there's seed of future suffering when we put those kinds of spins on our desire. But have desire that doesn't have a spin on it. Have desire simply to feel hungry and say, "You know, I think I'd like to have lunch." That's a nice desire. I mean, it's a normal desire. But to have a spin on that desire says, well, I need to have lunch right now, immediately, and it better be the most wonderful, perfect, sandwich with all the right kind of cheese, and it better be that everybody else sees that I, you know, have the most greatest lunch here. And, you know, we can add all these spins and desires to a simple desire that makes it painful for us to have it, to want to show off that we have the best lunch, as opposed to just, you know, eating because we're hungry. So it isn't all desire which is the problem. But one of the interesting things is it's possible to transform painful desires, desires for that have compulsion as part of them, desire that have fear as part of them, and transform it to a different kind of desire. And in Buddhism, they talk about dhammachanda. The word, one of the words for desire is chanda, which, just like the English word, can mean many forms of desire. But there's dhammachanda, there's kammachanda, and kammachanda is the desire for, which is more usually a problematic desire. It's desire for sensual enjoyments, for its own. And dhammachanda is a desire for dhamma, for dharma. And one of the ways that people sometimes translate dharma is truth. It's a desire for truth. And so the idea is it's possible to move from a desire for sensual pleasures, desire for relief from unpainful situations. It's possible to move from the kind of desires that have the spin of compulsion or fear or resistance, and move that desire, or compost or transform that desire to desire for truth. And I think that's one of the things, one of the foundations of mindfulness practice, is the inspiration to for discovery of truth. What is the truth? There's a poem the Buddha recited once, where he said this. And I'll take the word dhamma as being truth here. Truth is, it's talking about a monk or a nun who has attained freedom. Truth is his dwelling. Truth is his delight. A monk or nun pondering truth, calling truth to mind, does not fall away from truth. Whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, his or her mind, restrained within, arrives right at peace. So somehow living in truth, being dedicated to truth. And so the question is, what is truth, and why is it so interesting to pursue? I think it's interesting to pursue because the opposite of that is to live a life of a lie. And many of us live all kinds of subtle, maybe not lies is kind of dramatic word, but we see the world through certain false views or false understandings. One of the false understandings has to do with who we are as a self. Many of us have fixed notions of who we are as a self. And the sad things about any kind of fixed notion we have about ourselves is that implies there's no possibility for change. That if who I am is a fixed idea of who I am, then, and we limit ourselves to this fixed idea of who we are, then there's no sense of a possibility that, oh, I can change into something better. I can improve my life. I can become freer. I can discover the truth. And this is something that a limitation that many people will often initially have when they encounter Buddhist practice, is to say, well, I can't change, and this is who I am. I'm stuck this way. I'm always going to be a lazy person, or I'm always going to be someone who is a victim, and always someone who is not good enough, or always someone who's depressed, or always someone who's this way. And to have this notion that I'm always this way is a kind of a lie. It's kind of a false perception of what's going on. And to see the truth of who we are more deeply is to understand that who we are is fluid. There's no fixed sense of self, no fixed reference for who we are. And it's actually also possible then to change who we are, to change, to grow and develop, not to be limited by a certain category. There's a limited view that sometimes we have that it's kind of related to this, the idea of permanence, that we can have permanent security, that a bank account or a stock options or a certain kind of relationship or a certain kind of home or a certain kind of this or that is going to provide some kind of security. It does provide some kind of security, but it's not going to provide ultimate security. And to put all your eggs in one basket, as they say, to put all your eggs in the stock market, or put all your eggs in having a retirement plan, or all your eggs in, you know, that this is going to do it for you, is kind of a, you know, you can be successful in that way, but to depend on ultimate security in these things is asking for, I don't know if asking, but it lends itself to the possibility of tremendous disappointment, because there's no guarantee that any of these things last. We all know examples of people whose lives have turned themselves upside down overnight or over day. My friend who had her house and her office burn in the Oakland fire, and all she had with her, when she went to the beach that day, and all she had with her was her car keys and her driver's license and her towel. And she came back and everything she owned, her office and all her papers and the book she was writing, and, you know, she was no longer there. So things can change pretty dramatically. I'm reminded regularly how close I live to the San Andreas Fault. I don't know how many of you guys think of this. I talked to someone recently who lives 500 feet or so from the San Andreas Fault. And that's an interesting one to live near. Things can change pretty quickly. So the idea of permanence is one that, at least in the Buddhist tradition, we say is a kind of misperception, to see things as being permanent, that this is the way things are going to be forever. It's a kind of a lie, it's kind of a misperception of how things are. So the pursuit of truth. I think truth seeks itself. It's not so much that we need to seek the truth. I think truth wants itself. Things as they are. Things want to shine forth. Things want to be alive as they are, as opposed to having some kind of imposition on top of them, or some idea of how they should be or what they should be or some limitation. So I think it's almost like truth seeks itself, is the feeling I have. It's not so much that I'm seeking the truth, but it's more like if I'm sensitive to truth seeking itself, that then I almost want to get out of the way so that truth will just kind of be revealed. I don't want to be in the stand in the way. I don't think truth in this sense is not an object. It's not like a proposition you could state, oh, this is what's true. It's more like getting out of the way. It's more like it gets revealed. It's more like a state of being open to the truth. It's more like the idea of talking about truth today came from talking with a friend of mine last weekend. And she talked a lot about the truth, and she said, you know, when you experience your truth, it's just like, you just relax. And she made this gesture where her chest became more open and relaxed. And you're just open to the truth. It's so great. And so it's not so much like a proposition, like a belief. You can say, this is what the truth is. But I think the truth is something we open to and get out of the way for, and then it's kind of there. We kind of experience it. People often come and ask, how can I work with a difficult emotional state? How can I deal with my anger? And often what I hear in that kind of language is often, how can I get rid of it? How can I stop having it? How can I do something with it to make it better? And what I seldom hear is someone coming to me to say, you know, I have a lot of anger or I have a lot of fear. How can I discover the truth in the fear? How can I discover the truth of the fear? As opposed to, how can I deal with the fear? And I think it's possible to discover the truth in the fear, and discovering the truth of the fear is to become free of it, or become free, or to find some ease, or find some freedom in it. So what is the truth of the fear? As long as we're trying to look beyond it, to some solution to it, as long as we're trying to look at something different, which is better, as long as we're pursuing happiness and not really dealing with what's in front of us directly, we're not going to find the truth. But the truth of fear is the experience of fear in and of itself without the imposition of our ideas or our preferences on top of it. Truth doesn't belong to the world of our preferences. So to experience the fear without our preferences, to experience the fear without our resistance to it, just to experience the fear as tightness and confusion in our chest and our mind, that's to discover, that's to be with the truth of the fear itself. And to do that fully is to be freeing. When the truth gets revealed, then we're released from, then we find release. When truth is revealed, then we become released from what's happening. It isn't something necessarily that we do, but something that happens to us. I don't know if this follows, but I want to tell another story, another Sufi story. The story is told that an area of used to be northwestern India, now it's the area of Pakistan, Afghanistan. There was a family who had a son, and when the son seemed pretty bright and showed a lot of promise, so when the son was 8 years old, the father decided that he would send this son to study with a great spiritual master who lived in the next valley. And so the son went there and studied, and for 10 years he studied all the different books, of great books of spirituality that this teacher had, and studied, learned a lot of the spiritual practices the teacher had, and gained a tremendous amount of knowledge and understanding, and was recognized in his own right as being kind of a teacher, and actually started teaching some of the younger boys who was studying with this particular teacher, this master. And when he turned 18, the master said, "You know, you've learned everything I had to teach you now. And you have a tremendous amount of knowledge. I'm going to send you back now. You can go back to your father." So he goes back to his father's a farmer. He goes back to his farmer father. And rather than kind of going and joining in the work in the fields, the son is kind of full of himself. He's kind of like, you know, "I'm this real hot scholar and widely respected for my knowledge." And he doesn't waste any time. Mostly he wants to kind of make sure everybody understands how knowledgeable he is and how wise he is and how much he's learned. And no one has as much knowledge as he does in that valley. And he wants to, you know, continue reading his books and be pompous. And this, you know, his father, after a while, gets kind of troubled by this kind of attitude. You know, there's work to be done, and you know, he sent his son off to be trained with his great master, and he got this arrogant man back. So finally, the father says, "You seem to have learned a lot. It seems the great master in the next valley taught you a lot. But did he teach you that which cannot be taught? Did he teach you that which cannot be taught?" And that stopped the son. "What do you mean, that which cannot be taught? I thought I learned everything that was important." "It seems like you didn't learn everything. But you better go back to that teacher of yours and tell him that you want to learn what cannot be taught." So he goes, he rushes back, because this idea of not knowing something was... So he went back to this next valley. And the great master said, "Oh, you want to learn what cannot be taught. I see. You see those 200 sheep over there? Yeah. I want you to take them and go up into the mountains and not come back until you have 1,000 sheep. They've multiplied and you have 1,000 sheep. And then I'll teach you what cannot be taught." Okay. So he goes up into the mountains, and he says, "This, you know, great, I'll do this." And he goes up to the mountains, and the first night that he's up there, some wolf comes along and eats two of the sheep. And the next night, a couple of more sheep kind of wander off and get lost and fall off a cliff. So there's now 196. And then winter comes in, and he didn't know anything about sheep farming, and so he hadn't saved enough food for all the sheep for the winter, and half of the remaining sheep die. So springtime comes along, and he has about 75 sheep left. He's going in the wrong direction. He needs 1,000 sheep in order to get to have the Zen master, the great master, teach him what cannot be taught. So he says, well, I better start paying more attention here. So he starts learning this next year, next season, he starts learning the various skills of the shepherd and taking care of the sheep and learning about the plants and the flora. And slowly, slowly, the number of sheep increase again. He's back to 200. And it continues. In some years, the number of sheep increase. In some years, the wolves get them, or it's really cold that winter, and more of them die, and he gets fewer, and somehow goes up and down over the years. And he continues. You know, he realizes in the beginning he keeps counting his sheep. Every few days he keeps counting to see, because he needs to get to 1,000. But after a few years of this, he stops counting. He forgets about counting. He forgets about why he's even there, just taking care of the sheep. And he finds this great joy just being in the mountains. It's a beautiful place in the mountains, and snow-capped, and this beautiful vegetation and just beauty of this open sky. And he enjoys being a shepherd and being just alive day to day and taking care of the sheep and learning more about the plants and the animals and just being alive and breathing this clear air. And he kind of forgets all about the reason he went up to the mountains to begin with. He's just happy to be there, happy to be alive. And he continues this way each day in, day out, just kind of doing his thing, taking care of the sheep. And then one day, it's a nice warm day, and he's done the day's work, and he's sitting in the shade, kind of relaxing, and then he remembers, oh, wait a minute. Many, many years ago, I seem to remember, I was supposed to be here until I had 1,000 sheep, and then I was supposed to go back, and then the great master was going to teach me what cannot be taught. And, well, maybe, you know, at the end of the winter, end of the season, maybe I'll wander down there with my sheep. So let me count the sheep. So he counts the sheep. And he had more than 1,000 sheep. Wow. Okay, so maybe I'll go, maybe at the end of the season, you know, I'll wander down there and see what that was about. So, he continues and takes care of the sheep, and end of the season he kind of wanders down into the valley again and enjoying the sky, enjoying the wind and the breeze as he goes, and enjoying all the sheep that he has around him. And the great master sees him coming, and he goes up to him and gives him a big hug, and he says, I see you. I see that you learned what couldn't be taught. And what he learned was what couldn't be taught was how to just be alive and content with life as it is, and to find a simplicity of being, simplicity of just being with oneself and being with truth, that didn't involve having a lot of knowledge or thinking you had to be somebody special. Didn't involve being the great teacher. It didn't involve trying to run away from anything. It was just being there with what the actual situation is like in a very simple way. And the story is kind of very somewhat personal for me, because in a kind of very modified way, one of my great entries to my spiritual life, to life of feeling deeply at home with the world and with life, was actually living on a farm and taking care of cows, not sheep. And I didn't do it for that long. I didn't do it for years and years. But there was something very wonderful about the simplicity of just being alive with nothing to attain, nothing to do, nothing to become, just taking care of things day in, day out in a beautiful farm. That is where I say I discovered, I learned how to breathe when I at the end of my time at the farm, I said, oh, I think I've learned how to breathe. And I always knew how to breathe, of course. We all know how to breathe from the time we get born. But there was some, I knew how to breathe, with my breath became free. My breath was now free. It wasn't full of fear or anxiety or worry or whatever. Just to be alive is enough. And how do you learn that just to be alive is enough? I don't think that you can learn that from books. I don't think you can learn that from... I don't know what we learn it from. I think... but we learn it from trusting the truth, finding the truth. And the truth... I'm saying all this because the truth is not a proposition. It's not an object out there. The truth is something that's found when we get out of the way from it. When we allow that which is true in the moment to exist in its full glory, to exist there fully in our awareness. And we use mindfulness practice. One of the ways to use mindfulness practice is not as a goal-oriented activity to get someplace in the future. You know, if I get enough concentration, then something wonderful will happen. But it's possible to use mindfulness practice as a practice which tries to open to what is true right now for each of us. What is true at this very moment for us? And there's always something which is true. The Zen Master Dogen has the expression, the issue at hand. What is the issue at hand? What is the truth that's at hand? Because not the truth that's in the future, not the truth that can be found necessarily by doing all kinds of wonderful practices, but what is the truth that's actually true right now? Is there some impatience? Is there some fear? Is there some resistance? Is there some calm or some delight? Is there some feeling discomfort? What is actually happening right now? And can we see what's happening right now as a kind of a truth? Or do we see it kind of as a provisional thing? Oh, this is all, you know, true, you know, okay for now, but I'm really trying to get to something more wonderful beyond that. The truth that can be found any place and anything is right now by focusing on what is the issue at hand? What is actually tangible in this experience right now? What's happening right now? And that's almost like a mantra that it's possible to use for mindfulness practice. What is happening right now? Not my ideas of what's happening, because ideas are often somewhat removed from the truth. But what is the issue at hand? What is that which is close at hand? What is that really close to me that I can actually feel the truth of it? To meet someone and have all kinds of ideas about who they are. It's not necessarily the truth. But to meet them, and in meeting them, to feel delight or to feel fear. To feel that delight in oneself or to feel that fear in one, that is true in that moment. And can we open to that truth and allow it to be there and not be embarrassed for it or not to try to cling to it, hold on to it? What is the truth in any given moment? So Dhammachanda, the desire for truth, can motivate one. So rather than being motivated by the desire for worldly success, for money or for fame or for security or for sensual enjoyments, they're fine in and of themselves, but to put all our eggs in that basket is to miss a great opportunity. To be pursuing self-gratification, to pursuing, you know, how I can look good or what's good for me, is to miss the opportunity, the possibility of discovering truth. And truth has nothing to do with self, nothing to do with our ideas of self, nothing to do with self-gratification. Truth is much bigger than that. So Dhammachanda is the desire for truth, the wish for truth, the inspiration, the impulse for truth. And I believe that all of us have this great impulse for the truth. And the truth is not so far away. And I've known all too many people, including myself, who have lived a kind of a deception. I know I've lived a deception at times by looking for some kind of goal for my spiritual life that is attainable in the future. If only I could do this, if only that would happen. And sacrifice in the process of that the truth. And now I'm much more I find myself much more interested, what is the truth in the present moment for me? That's much more interesting for me. I feel a kind of passion for that, as opposed to trying to do something, find something that's in the future. If I follow these techniques, X, Y, and Z, then something wonderful will happen to me. Wonderful things can happen to you, but it's possible to sacrifice the truth of the present. And I actually find myself much more interested in coming back to the truth moment to moment than I am to any kind of spiritual attainment. But maybe that is a spiritual attainment, to begin resting more and more in the truth of the present moment as it's occurring. There was a story of a rabbi or some kind of Jewish teacher who died. And at his funeral, many people came from all over. He was a very famous spiritual teacher. And so people came from all over to pay their respects at his memorial service. And people who weren't his students were very curious about what kind of man he'd been and what it had been like to be his students. They went up to his students and asked about him. And one person asked, what was the most important thing for your master? And the student said, whatever he was doing at the moment. That was a great answer. What was the most important thing for your master? He was probably expecting some wonderful answer like, you know, the truth, or you know, the realization of God, or, you know, there's all kinds of wonderful ideals a person could live their life, base their life on. What was the most important thing for your master? Enlightenment. And the answer was, whatever he was doing at the moment, that was the most important thing. A lovely answer. What is it? What is the truth of this particular thing that you're doing right now? What is the truth of what's happening right now? What is a truthful way of being engaged? To open to it fully and let it speak to you. Let it reveal the truth to you. What is the truth of your sadness? What is the truth of your joy? What is the truth of your depression? What is the truth of your inspiration? There's truth in all things. And the task of mindfulness is to discover the truth that resides in everything, all things and in everything. And I won't say the truth will set you free, but I will say that the experience of truth comes with release. And that the experience of freedom in Buddhism. You know, it's interesting. I read recently, I don't know if I have to track this down and see if it's true, that the expression enlightenment in English that's used so commonly in our circles, in Buddhist circles, was coined by D.T. Suzuki when he was this great Zen teacher, Zen scholar who introduced this kind of Zen to the West. And I don't know if it's true that he coined it, but someone must have coined it. Because it's not a Buddhist word. The Buddhist word is release or freedom. And what ultimately Buddhism is looking for is release. To be released from living a life of a lie or deception. To be released from that which keeps us, keeps the truth at bay. So to live the truth, to discover the truth moment by moment, and thereby by doing it, to release ourselves, to be released by the truth, is a wonderful thing that's possible. So that was my little thing on truth. I hope it was true enough. And regardless if it was true or not, there's truth to be found, even in lies. Even, you know, there's a truth of my voice speaking right now. There's the truth of the vibrations that you hear. There's a truth of your reactions. There's a truth of how your body feels at the end of a day of sitting. There's a truth of me being a little bit tired at the end of a one-day sitting like this. There's truth happening all the time. So what is your truth? What is your response? What is your questions? truth of silence. Yes?
I have a question about the more practical aspects of seeking the truth. So let me give a specific example that perhaps you can respond to. Let's say I'm struggling right now with buying a car.
Buying a car?
Yeah. I have a 10-year-old car. It runs fine, and I'm bored with it.
Bored with it? The truth of boredom. That's a true statement. I'm bored with it. It's great. What's bored with a car?
So
you can be bored with something. That seems like a good one.
I actually had a dream last night that I came out of my house and the engine was like blown to the heavens. And I thought, oh good, now I have a real car. But anyway, so in struggling with this particular example, I see where the truth is. I'm putting an awful lot of energy into this decision, trying to justify it, knowing that I'm going to replace my car and buy a new one, knowing that I can do it responsibly from a financial standpoint, and yet still feeling terrible about it. And I can see, I think this is my truth. I can sort of see my struggle more or less objectively. And yet, standing back from that, I'm in the struggle, and I'm not really sure. I don't feel the release that this kind of perspective holds out.
I think the truth is you're struggling,
yeah.
And that's you start there. And so that's pretty good to start there. Some people struggle and don't know it. There are plenty of people who shop for cars and want cars and don't see all the different factors of their mind, their ideas and projections and fears and how they come into play, and just do it kind of unconsciously. You're bored, you said it very clearly, you're bored. So then that's a kind of truth, the truth of boredom. What are some of the other truths that are around that? What is your relationship to boredom? Why does boredom get translated into a certain kind of action? Is it do you uncomfortable with boredom? Do you repel from boredom? Is there judgment about boredom? Is there fear about boredom? Is it possible to let boredom just be? Just be boredom and not be troubled by it. What is your relationship to boredom? Because obviously, if that's really one of the core issues, there's something about boredom that stimulates you. And so it stimulates you because you have some relationship to boredom. And what is that?
It's an uncomfortable position to be in. And I think, I also have issues relating to instant gratification or, comforting now. So there's certainly sort of an impulse to want to stop the boredom.
Uh-huh.
But I guess, let's say I sit with
that impulse.
That good question that you asked. I mean, that's a good one, sort of exploring what it means to be bored or want to impulsively quash an unpleasant feeling.
Yeah.
Do I buy the car? I mean, so it's sort of, and then, and so, act out of that. At what point does the release come? What if it doesn't come? Then move on knowing, buy a car, don't buy a car, but the point is push on knowing that you are in it. At what point do you move past it? Do you stay in it forever? And I guess I'm going to walk more on the issue of action within.
So if you're looking for release, there's something that you feel that is tied down, that's caught. What is that for you? What is the caughtness that you feel? What's the compulsion that you feel? What is it that would be released if you found the release?
This hesitation or resist or judgment or all the things that come with moving into action.
So the judgment around action. So what is that judgment for you? How well do you understand? Do you understand well the judgment? Do you understand where the tightness, where the holding is? What's the truth of what's holding you back? What is the clinging? What is the tightening that you feel could be released? Do you understand that really well? Can you go into that and study that? Okay, what is the truth of that? It might not be the boredom, It might be something else, that maybe it's just a strong sense of desire. You know, there's kind of a churning desire inside of you. There can be just a desire for sensual pleasure, for delight. And that desire can be kind of a reaching forward and kind of a tightening. And to really go, turn the mirror of awareness back at that desire itself and see it really honestly, sometimes you realize, oh, I'm much more than that. I'm bigger than that. This is just a small piece of who I am. I don't have to buy into this. And in that moment of seeing it for what it is, there can be kind of a release from it. But you can't expect to have release unless you can identify what it is that's tying you down.
Well, what's release?
Release is untying the knot of clinging or of fear or resistance. There's some kind of tightness, some kind of clinging that represents a problem, it sounds like. If we're talking about release, we have to talk about that which is the opposite of release, which would be being tied down, being preoccupied, being compulsive, being worrying about something. And so we have to identify what that is and find the truth of that. If we can't find the truth of that, if we kind of have some vague idea, I don't feel so well and I don't feel so good and I need something to help me out and what is it, and you know, we're kind of bumbling in the dark. Then we're not going to find the truth. And we might find, you know, our way out of the dark a little bit. Maybe you'll find a good car, and then you find a good car, and then you find yourself, and it's no longer an issue for a while. But you just kind of haven't dealt with the roots of the issue. You just kind of found a little solution. If you feel there's a problem that you want release from, a person has to identify very clearly the suffering that you're experiencing. And maybe it's that you have impatience around boredom. And that impatience is true, it's what's happening. And that is, you're kind of a slave to impatience. Or maybe it's a feeling of inadequacy. You know, or maybe a 10-year-old car in this area. I had my car smog checked yesterday. And we have a car that's 12 years old, 13 years old. And the guy who was doing smog check said, oh, most of the cars here pass the smog check really easily. I used to do this kind of work in San Francisco on 19th Avenue. And one in every four cars didn't pass. But here almost all the cars pass. And I said, why? Oh, almost all the cars I see are about 3 years old. there's a, you know, around here, you know, a certain kind of peer pressure, you know, not to drive cars that are too old because, you know, you're not with it. You know, everybody else has their whatever. And so there's many forces inside of us that come into play. And what are they? Are they ones that are useful, the ones we want to live our life by, or are they not? And so if what we want is release, relief, or if what we want is to be freed from compulsion, from greed, or from clinging, it's very helpful to understand what actually the true issue is in the heart of it. And part of mindfulness is to begin sorting through the chaff of confusion and finding what that is. And what's interesting is that you don't have to take boredom for granted either. Once you're able to be with boredom in a non-reactive way, where the boredom doesn't automatically trigger an impulse to try to get rid of it, then it's possible to look through the cracks of the boredom and see that actually underneath the boredom there might be something else interesting that's true. There might be judgment. Some people, for example, I can imagine someone who doesn't feel a certain kind of delight in just being alive for its own sake, doesn't have the experience of tending sheep for 20 years and just discovering just wonderful, just to be alive is enough. You know, a lot of people in this kind of life that we live here don't have the experience that being alive is enough, that they feel like they need something to fill some kind of hole or a vacuum inside of themselves. They need to have a certain level of success to look good in front of other people. They need to have a certain kind of all kinds of need something to fill the hole within them. They feel like something is missing, inadequate in their life. And so to fill it, they sometimes fill it with sensual enjoyment. Sensual enjoyment is a very broad term in Buddhism. And for example, certain kind of sensual enjoyment is driving a hot new car that has a certain kind of spiff to it and certain kind of, you kind of look at that car and you kind of feel kind of happy when you look at it because it has a nice new sleek lines, and you kind of feel kind of younger or more alive yourself when you look at that kind of nice Maserati, you know, that seems, you know, that kind of. And so you get in that car and it kind of feels, kind of has this like takeoff and it picks up really quickly, and you feel kind of this vitality and joy, you know, and just, you can feel joy and vital kind of driving a nice sports car, and it has a convertible, and you know, the wind blows nicely through your hair, and it's like you feel really alive. And it's nice to do that, there's nothing wrong with it. But if that feels, if a person is going for that kind of vitality or aliveness, that in order to fill the sense of lack or boredom or emptiness or paleness in a person's life, is that really useful? Are you free then, or are you a slave? And I think in a sense we're kind of enslaved if we're simply doing things on automatic to fill that kind of emptiness. And I know a lot of people in our culture who do this around cars. I think cars are very common. There's kind of a religion in America around cars. And sometimes it's a fine religion, and sometimes it's a religion to fill some lack that people feel for themselves. So then the question is, what is the truth of this lack that I feel? And how do I relate to the sense of lack? Are you willing to enter into that lack and allow it to be there? Surrender to the truth of that. I feel empty. It doesn't feel good. But to fill that with yourself rather than fill it with objects. I don't know if this helps at all. I'm just talking. Does this sound a little bit familiar to some of you? Does it resonate a little bit of truth to it?
Can I ask a follow-on question? Moving away from the car story, it seems like there can be a lot of tension around striving for release.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
And that's, I think, one of the things that...
God, I love it. That's a great... Tension around striving for release. I love it. And then this whole thing of spiritual materialism. So watch out. So that's a very important truth to notice, that we can add suffering on top of our life by trying to free ourselves from suffering, to be release. So be very careful around that. And first recognize it. Be very sensitive. All of us who do spiritual practice should recognize this as a common phenomena, and be very sensitive, and to the best of your ability, try not to do that. Try not to make your the striving for release, striving for freedom. Try not to have that be tinged by enslavement, have be tinged by compulsion or fear, or striving or need or demanding, or instant gratification. Some people in spiritual circles expect instant gratification through mindfulness practice. And there is a kind of instant gratification that's possible, for sure. But it's often different than what they think it is. So I didn't answer your question, except mostly to say your concern is a great one. That you recognize that that's something you do, I commend you. That's really great. And I'd encourage you just to continue that kind of study of yourself, and to look more deeply at what's going on. What's going on in you when you're in a hurry or you're striving to get relief, release? We have to be, in order to really find release, you have to be comfortable. That's kind of a paradox, but you have to be one of the ways to find release is to be. Have a certain comfort, or certain will, comfort, but a certain willingness to suffer, so willingness to be tied down or to be in a knot. There has to be that willingness there, and that willingness will open to something greater. Willingness is a great term. Willingness to accept who we are. Willingness to accept the truth. It's the willingness to accept the truth that sometimes releases the truth. I'll tell you, I've said this sometimes, it's kind of a joke, but it's kind of profound. Not exactly a joke. I'll tell you a joke, and then I'll tell you the more profound story. And maybe the more, looks like the more profound one you'll forgive me for the joke. There was an executive of a corporation who was a brilliant executive. She was a brilliant executive, and it has to be. I think it has to be a man to make it work better. Maybe. Anyway, And he had to make, but he had one flaw, one problem. And that is when he had to make, periodically he had to make major presentations in front of a room full of other executives. And when he did this, he would pee in his pants, which was a little bit difficult, embarrassing to be in his big, you know, in front of all these executives making presentations and having his wet pants. So the CEO of the company, you know, called him to his office one day and said, you know, we got to work on this problem of yours. because, you know, you get embarrassed and then you get all flustered in the middle of your presentation, and we have to work on this. We have to, you know, you're a great employee. So he sent him to the company psychologist and said, you know, maybe he can help you. She can help you. And so after some weeks, executive came back to the CEO and said, I'm cured. Great. You mean you no longer pee in your pants? Oh no, I'm no longer embarrassed. Accepting things as they are. So the other story is someone wrote this about this guy's kind of a personal account. He writes, I was miserable, I was suffering. I knew I had to change, but I didn't know how. And what made it worse is all my friends told me I had to change. You have to change, you have to change. And I just couldn't know how to change. I felt more and more miserable. Finally, I encountered a friend who simply told me, don't change. I love you just the way you are. And those words were music to my ears. I love you. You don't have to change. I love you just the way you are. And I could accept myself, and I relaxed. And then I changed. So there's a kind of a paradox of change that happens. That sometimes by accepting ourselves fully as we are, accept the truth of ourselves, the truth that's here right now fully, without resisting it or trying to make it better, that sometimes that willingness to experience that itself provides the change or the release. But it takes finding what is really true. What is it that most deeply inside of us needs to be accepted? And that is part of the task of mindfulness sometimes, is to ask that question. What is it that most deeply inside of me that needs to be accepted? And sometimes if you do that, you'll change, you'll find the relief. But you have to be very careful when you do that then. If you're really going to accept things, you have to accept them for what they are. You don't have to use it. Acceptance is a strategy so you can get relief. Right? Okay, I don't like this. I'm going to really accept it. So it goes away. You have to accept it in its own terms. You have to accept the truth as it is and not have an agenda. And the beautiful thing about truth, as I understand it, is it's not personal. So it's not being engaged in life always from the perspective of what is personally best for me. What is best for truth? So anyway, my wish always, the truth of my wish is that I wish always to figure out what is most supportive for you as you do your practice, as we do our practice together. And so the spirit of my trying to give these talks is try to say something which is helpful and supportive. And probably sometimes I say things which are not supportive and helpful. Sometimes I probably say things that are not useful. So anything I might have said today which is not useful, leave it here. Forget about it. And may whatever benefit we've had from this day of practicing together, may whatever merit we've had from this day of practicing together, may it be for the benefit of ourselves, of our families and friends and neighbors and community. May it be for the benefit of all the people we encounter in the next days. May it be for the benefit of all beings everywhere. May all beings everywhere be happy. May all beings everywhere be free. So thank you. A couple of announcements.